ancient ancestor Matsu said, ordinary mind is the way. Without grasping or rejecting anything, mind as it is, reflecting all as it is the way. And Matsu said, the mind as suchness is like a clear mirror which can reflect images. The mind reflecting dharmas. And if the mirror mind grasps objects, dharmas, it's obscured. An ordinary mind becomes contrived. So simple, this ordinary mind, but so elusive. So many types of grasping. Therefore, we have so many practices to enter into and see if there's grasping. And one practice realm we have in Zazen is we all have these unique positions. And I was thinking how it stands out even more clearly in such a small group because it's so important what each person is doing. And we have with these inherited positions from these ancient ancestors. I think in Matsu's time, they also, there was the Tenzo cooking, there was the Ino organizing the form of the retreat and the Zendo, and there was the Jisha or Jiko attending to the Dharma teacher and helping making offerings and so on. And there's the Soku organizing the meals, taking the Tenzo's food and helping it be distributed to the assembly. And each of these practice positions has its own unique challenges and potential for grasping, doesn't it? So wonderful. We all have our unique ways. And then, you know, we get to change it around some and see how to work with it in all the different positions. And I think it's not just, they're not just like, you know, jobs, so we can cook the food and get the food out and organize the Zendo. I mean, we could see it that way, because they do have this very practical side. But they also, each position has its you know, deep Dharma practice mode or opportunity. And as the days of Zazen go on, I think it becomes more apparent. In some ways, it becomes, each role becomes easier because we're like, we're remembering how it works again and we're settling more into it. And at the same time, as the days go on, our mind and body may become more clear and aware And then we see like the next level of grasping and rejecting mind in the details. You know, it's there in the details, and of our own, you know, how we're doing our own job, and also how all these positions are completely interconnected. And again, especially clear in such a very intimate group, such a small group of people like this. Maybe it will be disturbing when more people come tomorrow to our little nucleus. But how we're all harmoniously interacting, and it would often strike me at a place like Tassajara, where it's the same thing, but there's just a lot more positions and more interaction, and how it's so complicated, and yet each person plays their part completely. And if one person was missing, in a way, you could say the whole thing would just completely fall apart. And how much more so in this group, if one person, so don't get sick or anything, okay? One person disappeared, we'd be in trouble. And yet we don't even really know what the other positions are exactly doing. We're just, you know, they're happening off in the kitchen or in the office or something. We don't know, but it seems to all be coming together. And I think it's a great gift of Sesshin in particular to appreciate how this works just naturally without, you know. We formally appreciate it at the end when we do a cook's jundo and we thank everybody's position, basically. In a way, we're not really thanking them like personally, like, oh, it's so good to sit with you personally. And we do feel that too, but the ceremony is kind of, we acknowledge the roles. Thank you for playing this role in this mandala. And each of these positions has its own unique mirror practice, reflecting what's happening. Without, you know, returning to the clear reflecting mirror that doesn't grasp or reject the images in it. And this is just a metaphor, and I think the mirror is a wonderful metaphor, and it's playing on the visual sense field. Mirror is all about the visual objects being reflected back. But this could apply to all the five or six senses. And thinking of other images for other senses, none quite match the mirror metaphor, because the mirror not only does it just receive whatever image is put before it, receives it with equanimity, and it doesn't reject any image, and it doesn't grasp any image. That's one of the other things. It just reflects it back. The image doesn't stick on the mirror. So I thought of, well, for sound, the mind, like the CD recorder, it just receives the sound. It doesn't judge whether it's a good or bad talk, and it doesn't grasp the words. It just receives them. It records them completely clearly without any distortion. It doesn't alter them and say, well, you know, I would change that word to this word, so I'm going to record it like that. No, it just records it, receives it, and records it exactly how it is. And it can reflect it back later when we play it back, which is not quite as great as a mirror that's just reflecting instantly. And there's nothing left. You can't go back to the image in the mirror. Only one momentary image, each reflection. But still, this CD recorder is practicing very well with us. I think it's just quietly doing its receiving a thing in there, and in a very unbiased kind of way, and for our benefit, just like a mirror benefits beings, this, you know, recorder records words just so people can listen to them later. I don't know if that's necessarily beneficial, but supposedly that's why we do it, or why we let it do this receiving function. And in the smell realm, what's like a mirror for smell? Well, maybe like cloth, fabric, just absorbs the smells around it. It just receives it, them, and takes them in. And so if we're around the incense a lot, robes might start to smell like incense a little bit. Sometimes people even put these little powdered incense pouches in their robe sleeve to have it permeate the cloth. And if we're, you know, hanging around a skunk, it permeates also. Or fire smoke is a big one. Even from our New Year's Eve fire here, I noticed like for like a week afterwards, everything, clothing kind of smells like smoke. So this clothing just, it doesn't prefer incense over fire smoke. It just receives it, the smell, directly. And maybe it does kind of grasp it a little bit, kind of holds it. And then, but then it eventually releases it. And for taste, I think it's in the Tenzo Kyokun, Dogen says, a monk's mouth is like an oven. Does that sound familiar? And I think that's what it's referring to, like the mirror mouth, the oven mirror. In other words, an oven doesn't care what kind of food gets put in it. It just receives whatever is put in there, and whether it's good food, bad food. And so, and Orioki is like this, right? We just, the food comes graciously from the Tenzo's cooking efforts, and we just receive it, quite literally, we receive the food, and then when we're done, we chant, may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. So this kind of like, we might be really into the meal during the meal, we might fall into some kind of grasping or aversion during the eating, or maybe not. Ideally we can just receive it and taste it for what it is, and then be done. And then the chant, I kind of feel like if there was any muddy water grasping during the meal, and I don't know if this is why that chant is done at the end, but it kind of has that feeling to me of like, it's kind of like a little bit messy, this whole realm of like tastes and food and eating and preference and all of that. And so, but in that world, that muddy world, may we exist with purity like a lotus. Thus we bow to Buddha, and we're done. That meal, like, during the week, we might think, this is a good one, this is a bad one, this is a neutral one, and now we're done. And we bow to Buddha and go on to the next thing. And the Tenzo starts the next meal. And the body sense, I couldn't think of a metaphor for the physical, you know, what's, because almost like it's just the body itself is the mirror. We just, the body just receives its bodily feelings, pleasure or pain, good or bad, and it's, we just receive them and let them be, is the practice. Nothing's like the body. Maybe that's why I can't think of a metaphor. If y'all think of one, let me know. But all these other senses, all these other, you know, sense objects impact other types of realms, but the you know, physical sensations is so unique to the body. And the mind realm, this is the main one that all these metaphors could be referring to, although we can definitely do it with all these senses like this. I think when they're talking about mirror mind, it's a metaphor for thoughts and conceptual objects, but also with the senses, directly with the sense experiences themselves, just receiving and reflecting. But particularly with thoughts, right? I think this is, I don't know if this is true for all of us, but I would say so for me for sure, is that these, is that the conceptual thinking realm is the most sticky, the most hard to just reflect equanimously, the hardest not to grasp or reject our thoughts and feelings, you know. And conceptions themselves, you know, the other four skandhas. The form skandha is these five senses. Actually, that's how the Buddha defines form skandha, is the sense organs and the sense objects. So when the Buddha says in his first sutra, in brief, grasping the five skandhas is discontent. The definition, the very definition of discontent or suffering. We have, so then not grasping or rejecting the five skandhas is the end of discontent. He quite magnificently called nirvana sometimes. Complete not grasping for even a moment, we could say, is a complete moment of nirvana, when the fuel is released from the fire and the fire has nothing more to burn. So we have our sense experiences to just reflect like a CD recorder and an oven and so on. And then we have this onslaught of mental conceptions and feelings and judgments about ourself and others. And ironically, they seem even more believable than the sense objects. You'd think that the sense objects would be more, they're physical, right? They're like colors and sounds and stuff. But in a way, we don't really grasp them as strongly as these purely fabricated mental images that are, you know, based sometimes on and connected with sensory world. You know, like where our body's hurting and then we get all kinds of stories going in the conceptual realm about should I do something about this, or and this shouldn't be happening, or why do I get this body, and you know, it's kind of based on the sensory stuff. But the conceptual thinking part is much easier to grasp or reject. So this, all these metaphors could work. Mind like an oven. Mind like an oven that just receives whatever's put in it, right? Mind like the fabric that just receives whatever scent is comes in contact with it, and particularly mind like a mirror. This is Matsu's image. And Matsu's disciple, Baijang, came to Matsu. And early on, practicing with him, he said, he asked, what is the essential import of this school of Zen? And Matsu said, it's the very place where you let go of your body and life. Which sounds very much like drop off body and mind. That's the essential import of the school. And that's that very place where we let go of body and life is this mirror mind. Let go means not grasp, like a mirror. And then, one time, after they were practicing together for a while, Matsu and Baijang were walking along, and some wild ducks flying by. You know this story? This is Baijang's enlightenment story. So, student and teacher Matsu and Baijang, who later became famous for hanging out with this fox that Kathy told us about recently. But in this case, he's hanging out with ducks. Yeah, he likes animals. But he wasn't really like, well, in both cases, he just received the fox who came. In this case, just received these ducks that happened to be flying by. Wild ducks. Wild ducks and Matsu, teacher, checking on Baijang, said, what is that? And one version of the story says they were calling, like, and so one version says, what is that sound? So I think either way works. Again, it's visual and auditory. What is that up there that we see, or what is that sound? It's all our experiences coming through our sense gates. And Baijang said, wild ducks. That sight or that sound is wild ducks. Matsu said, where have they gone? Or where has the sound gone? And Baijang said, flown away. Sounds kind of like the mirror mind. The ducks that were just reflected in the mirror are now no longer reflected. The sound is only one moment. I think particularly with sound, it struck me. I just saw this recently that this saying, where did the sound go? Because sound is really a moment, and then it's gone. I mean, visual images are too, but...
Who said what there?
So Matsu, the teacher, is kind of like, I think he's kind of checking out the student, Baijang. So the teacher, Matsu, asks, what's that? Actually, there's a little... And because maybe this is to understand why he would ask, what's that? There was something that, maybe I won't try to find it, but, I think the story is that very strange short little story that about Matsu and Baijiang before this story happened, because it said every day that some kind of food like miso or something was in this container, and maybe it was that Baijiang was Matsu's jisha or something like this, and he would bring him this container of miso and open it up, and every time Matsu would say, "What's that?" Every day the same thing would happen. So he's the kind of guy who asks, "What's that?" Maybe he was asking that all the time, and there wasn't, you know, not much came of it. So this time they're walking along, they see and hear the geese, "What's that?" It's another time asking, "What's that?" So the master said, "Ah, it's wild ducks, master. Like, why do you always have to ask me?" And where have they gone? And flown away. And you could say he's just answering, like, just very down to earth logically. Or this could be like in the you know, they're always talking in metaphors, often talking in metaphors. Or these stories can be seen on a very practical level, and they can be seen on a and they're also speaking in this like metaphorical level, or, you know, representing. So, you know, what's this image? It's ducks. Where's it gone? Flown away, like, you know, on the symbolic level, we could say it's like they're, you know, there's nothing left, completely gone. In my mirror mind, there's nothing left of it. I'm not thinking about the sound anymore, it's gone. I'm not thinking about the ducks. Flown away, gone, flown. And then Matsu immediately turned around and grabbed Baijiang's nose. And it doesn't say here, but some versions of the story say, and twisted it. and quite hard, apparently, because feeling pain, Baijiang let out a cry. "Ouch!" And, you know, unexpected. And then Matsu said, "Still you say flown away?" At these words, the master had insight. Or this was maybe even his awakening. So, it's ducks. But now they're gone, they're flown away. Nothing at all. Free, like this. You still say nothing, flown away, gone? So you could see this is also could be playing with form and emptiness. And a kind of, he's testing. When you say flown away, if flown away means empty, nothing left, do you see that as a nihilistic emptiness? Do you see that as there's nothing at all? If so, how about this? You know, here's a new sensory experience. That one's gone. Here's another. And is it flown away right at the time it's happening? Is this nose twist pain? Do you still say flown away? And it doesn't say, he doesn't answer, but that very question plummets him into this insight. You know, is there a flown away quality to, like, right at the time of the pain? is there a way in which, and this is maybe a koan we can take into the physical pain of Sesshin. Do we still say flown away? Right in the midst of the sore back or legs. And, it, you know, it's not like yes, flown away, or no, not flown away. Just insight. But then he seemed to be changed after this. Baijiang was kind of like this different person after this strange little encounter about the wild ducks. He seemed to just be living more freely in this mirror mind. So maybe when he first said flown away, it was just this idea of flown away. It was just an idea of, oh, the image is gone. Yeah, it's cool. No problem. And then this nose twist came. And maybe it was some kind of integration of, right in the midst of the sensory experience, it was flown away. It was flown away, or it was just reflected as it was, with no grasping or rejection. So in this changed Baijiang now, you know, how bad could the nose twist hurt? I mean, he didn't like, you know, he just twisted it. He didn't, you know, pull it off or anything, or cut it or anything like that. He just twisted his nose, and I guess it hurt, but the Baijiang returned to the attendants' quarters, wailing pitifully. I mean, maybe it really hurt, but I think there was something different about him. He was just freely crying. And another monk, who was another of Matsu's attendants, asked him, "Are you thinking of your parents? Is that why you're crying?" The master, Baijiang, said, "No." And this other attendant said, "Well, has someone reviled you? Criticized you?" He said, "No." "And then why are you crying?" And Baijiang says, "My nose was grabbed by the great teacher and the pain hasn't stopped." And you know, this is literally, like, just it's so painful that he twisted my nose. Or is the impact of this, you know, the physical impact, just having this effect? The attendant said, "What happened? You know, why was your nose grabbed by the teacher? What happened? What didn't you realize?" it translates it here. "He must have grabbed your nose because, like, you didn't understand something he said." And some don't have that, but I think that's kind of a funny little twist on the story. What happened? What didn't you realize? Baijiang said, "Well, go ask the teacher. Go ask Matsu." So then this other attendant went and asked Matsu, "What incident happened that the attendant Huaihai, Baijiang, failed to accord with? You know, what did he do wrong, basically? He's in the attendant's quarters crying. Please explain this to me." And Matsu explained simply that Baijiang did indeed understand and told the other attendant to go ask him. He's getting the runaround, right? It's not that he didn't understand. He did understand. You go ask him what he understood. And the attendant's like, "Oh, great." So the attendant goes back, as sometimes happens, and they often do get the runaround in these stories, right? He went back and asked Baijiang, "The teacher says you understand. He told me to ask you myself. Like, what's going on?" So then Baijiang laughed. And now the attendant's like really confused. He said, "Just a minute ago you were crying. Now why are you laughing?" And this is the beautiful punchline, or, you know, head of the koan or something, I would say. Baijiang said, "Just then I was crying. Right now I'm laughing." And the attendant was at a loss. So a strange story. Like, some of them are more like, you can almost feel like somebody made them up, and they're very concise, and they you can see how it demonstrates a point very clearly. This one's just a little more involved and kind of strange, I think, and kind of over time, just like the fox story, got kind of like drawn out over days even. So But this is how he seems different now, is just then I was crying, right now I'm laughing. Just mirror mind. And then this is just this expanded version. So the next day Matsu went into the teaching hall to give the Dharma talk. And as soon as the community assembled, Bhajan came forward and picked up his zagu, which was the signal for the end of the talk. I guess as the attendant at the end of the talk, he had to pick up his zagu to leave. Maybe his zagu's down for the talk or something. But as soon as Matsu sits down, Bhajan like gets up and picks up his zagu, and then so then Matsu, taking that as the signal that the talk's over, just got up and left without saying anything. And he went back to his abbot's quarters, and Bhajan, the attendant, followed, and Matsu said, "Just then I hadn't said anything. Why did you pick up your zagu?" And Bhajan said, "Yesterday you grabbed my nose and it hurt." Matsu said, "Yesterday, where did you set your mind?" Bhajan said, "My nose doesn't hurt anymore today." Kind of like, I was crying and now I'm laughing. So, yesterday you grabbed my nose and it hurt. Well, yesterday, the master Matsu is kind of playing into this, talking about yesterday thing, and saying, "Well, yesterday, where did you set your mind? How did you receive this hurt from nose grabbing?" And Bhajan turns it back to right now and says, "My nose doesn't hurt anymore today." And Matsu says, "You have deeply understood yesterday's event." What a strange way of talking, isn't it? So beautiful, I think. So yesterday you grabbed my nose and it hurt. Yesterday, where did you set your mind? My nose doesn't hurt anymore today. You've deeply understood yesterday's event. So all this was actually preface. Just to see the interaction and connection and transition between Matsu and Bhajan into this seems to be a very important teaching of Bhajan about this mirror mind. Maybe Bhajan heard the teaching of Matsu about mirror, the ordinary mind like a mirror. So Bhajan later, now when he's teaching, says, "You must distinguish the terms of purity and impurity. You must distinguish them. Impure things have many names, such as greed, hate, delusion. Pure things also have many names, such as enlightenment, the cessation of suffering, liberation, etc. So you must distinguish the First Noble Truth and the Third Noble Truth. But while in the midst of the twin streams of purity and impurity, among such standards as profane and holy, amidst form, sound, smell, taste, touch, and phenomena, things of the world or things which transcend the world, the immediate mirror awareness should not have the slightest hair of grasping for anything at all. The immediate or present mirror awareness, and he refers to this over and over in his teachings by Jung. Well, this is the first place.
Immediate?
The immediate mirror awareness. And later, or maybe also translated as present, the present mirror awareness. Immediate mirror awareness. So, first he says you must distinguish between these all these dualistic things, samsara and nirvana. But while, you know, distinguish them, but then while in the twin streams of purity and impurity among such standards as, you know, ordinary and holy, and amidst all these five or six sense realms, sense objects coming at us constantly, form, sound, smell, taste, touch, and phenomena. The immediate mirror awareness should not have the slightest hair of grasping for anything at all. It should not, but, you know, the immediate mirror awareness cannot have the slightest hair of grasping. That's what it is. And particularly, you know, not grasping the impure greed, hate, and delusion, and but also not grasping nirvana and the pure. And he makes this point over and over. If we're really settled and no discontent, and such moments might arise in Sashin, not grasping such. An experience, just reflecting it like everything else, just what's happening. If one no longer grasps or rejects, and yet abides in not grasping or rejecting, and considers it correct, this is the elementary good. This is abiding in the subdued mind. This is one who is fond of the raft and will not give it up. And this is a result of meditation. The raft, meaning like using the immediate mirror awareness as a vehicle or a raft to cross over. And then dwelling in nirvana, not giving it up. So, there's more, but there's more days. And I find, in trying to work with this mirror awareness image, and it's quite interesting, I think, to, oh yeah, okay, mirror mind, and then to not be in a gross way or a subtle way, grasping that metaphor as the practice, you know, okay, mirror mind, just reflect. Yes, here it is. And like, almost like there's this image of the mirror still, or, you know, using that. Or, and even like, and then the assessing, like, is this it? Yeah, okay, okay, it's just about, but what, but then who's this talking? What's this running commentary about the mirror mind as it's reflecting? Or can that running commentary be reflected in this present awareness also? And it's also not something, maybe that partly comes from trying to create the mirror awareness, which is not, it's something that's already here. It's just our natural, our ordinary mind. So it doesn't need to be created. And yet there's that tendency, when we're distracted especially, okay, where's the mirror mind? Okay, let's do the mirror mind thing. Like, let's find, okay, here we go. Like, mirror mind, yeah, we got it. It's more like we're like constructing it, making it into something which maybe is a necessary step. Maybe there's time that we have to take up such a raft, and then can we just let the raft do its thing and take us wherever it will. Let the wind of the day carry the unmoored raft wherever it will. We're not even like trying to navigate to the other shore. Just mirror awareness. Any questions or comments? Maybe we can just, yes.
There are a lot of times where, you know, the mirror works for me with the senses.
Mm-hmm.
I can just receive the sense things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, occasionally, sort of incoherent thoughts will pass through my mind that don't hook me, but it seems like almost the minute a thought pattern arises, I'm in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and
yeah, how to reflect the thought pattern just like that? Because they have stronger hooks, bigger hooks, the thought patterns compared to just, I mean, not always, but I think usually, compared to just sensory world, they have like the content of the thought is gets us involved in the content, so we just don't remember. But if in the middle of the thought pattern, you know, if we don't remember, then we just don't remember. But if in the middle of it, we catch it and then just clearly observe, or just, you know, pop, the mirror goes out, and then the stuff can still keep happening, just like all the senses, they're not stopped. So the conceptual story can still, and this is, you know, different than the senses, but it's still doing its thing, but it's just, it's not, it kind of fizzles out quite quickly if it's reflected in the mirror, because now we're attending more towards the fact that it's just a conceptual story, instead of attending to the meaning or the content of the story. That's what the mirror does. It's just like very, it's very direct. It's not going to get involved in the content. And you could say, how can we remember that more often or something? But I think it's just, there's no way except just to continue in this fashion of sitting and let's say training the mind, or more like letting the mind be trained by the present. Because, you know, if we're trying to do something, that's already more conceptual stuff in a way. So it's really the backward step of just stopping. it's not not easy. And we're so used to having to be involved in the content of our thoughts that this is on some very deep, it's very threatening, I think, on some deep level to our very being to actually not get involved in them. Doesn't it seem like we, our very, like, identity is at stake? Because especially if they're thoughts that are really connected with our identity, like, I can't let this is something I really have to work on. Those ones maybe especially. I just like, the mirror goes up. it's not so much that, like, this is not something I have to work on, or I don't have to work on this, or this is not something to deal with in my life. That's just another one also. It's more like, just for the present moment, we're just, you know, doing this reflecting thing, and just to see what will happen. And we won't forget. I think if things are important to remember, we generally won't forget. They'll return after and during sesshin. Let us continue. Dedicating the merit to the realization of mirror-like awareness throughout all time and space. Beings are numbers.